So hey, this is Asa. Before we even get started, got something to tell you. Did you know that the 10K Society is open? No. Seriously, did you know that it's actually available? It actually is. So what is it? So 10K Society is the one thing that you need to stop feeling like the brokest bitch at brunch. No, seriously, you know that feeling. You go to brunch, you are fly. Like everybody's looking at you because, I mean, it's you. But then what happens? You get that menu and you realize you can't afford anything. But you're an entrepreneur. You're aspiring to build the business of your dreams. And you know it's possible. But you just don't know what you just don't know. So how about you just do this? Allow me to take your hand and walk you through the journey of what it means to be an entrepreneur. Because let's face it, nobody wants to be around the broke bitch at brunch. Go to 10ksociety.co. I say again, that's www.10ksociety.co, and allow me to make a difference for you now. Hello, hello, hello. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Asa Laveau, host of the Entrepreneur Show with Asa Laveau. I am so glad again that you have chosen to be at the right place, at the right time, with the right people. I am always ecstatic for you to be here. Though I cannot see you, I feel your presence and I so appreciate it. I do want to let you guys know, just in case you forgot, we have a proud and paid masterclass coming November 20th and 21st, 2020. And the whole reason, the entire reason that I decided to say yes to this experience is for you. I'm obsessed with you. I think you're kind of dope. That's all. And I started thinking that maybe as you are traversing your journey of being an entrepreneur, that you could use some support. You could benefit from seeing individuals who have gone before you, that have created a level of success that you would like to duplicate or that you would like to surpass. And I'm very interested in you surpassing any and everything that you see. So that's why I created the Proud and Paid Masterclass. Another reason why I decided to say yes, of course, because of you, is I know that feeling of not totally feeling okay with being your true self, in spite of you wanting to go into business for yourself. I know that feeling of, you know, you have a business, you have an idea that you want to get paid from, so it's not a hobby, it's a business. And you're thinking to yourself, you know, I have a great idea, but I'm not so sure people are going to get with the fact that I love the way I love, I party the way I party, I live the way I live. And I am here to call bullshit on that entire stinking thinking. That's why I'm here. That's why I was created, to call bullshit on all of that. Because why? You really can be everything you are and have everything you desire. You really can. And anybody that tells you no is full of shit. I'll say that on your behalf. You're full of shit. You really can be that. So today, because we are in preparation, we're gearing up for the Proud and Paid Masterclass. I have one of the quote-unquote dope as fuck speakers here today. And oh, by the way, if you don't know by now, we cuss here. We cuss often
and weak as well. Sometimes it's in context, a lot of times it's in context, but it's okay to drop an F-bomb every now and again, because that's what it's like to be authentically me. And what is this? The Entrepreneur Show with Ace Laveau. And Ace Laveau cusses sometimes. So we have our dopest fuck seeker, Eric G. Reed, here today. I'm very excited to bring him on because I believe that he is going to make a difference for you today. Not just today, but also during our two-day summit, our Proud and Paid Masterclass. I do not introduce people to you lightly. I do not allow anyone to enter your space. Believe me when I tell you, everyone that I ever bring in front of you is vetted. From a personal standpoint, a business standpoint, I desire to make sure that their heart is well, their mind is well, and their spirit is well, because you deserve to have someone that considers your feelings, your state of being every single time. And I am that person for you. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to you, Reed. Hello, Eric.
Hey, Asa, thank you for inviting me to spend this time with you and your guests.
Of course. We're going to have a little powwow for the next, you know, half hour, maybe even a little bit longer. So the three of us, you, me, and our beautiful human that's listening with us, we're going to have a little three-way powwow. And the first thing, before we go into deep things, I have to ask, what was your favorite toy growing up?
Oh, wow. My favorite toy growing up. You didn't prep me. There's like all of a sudden my Curious George doll rushing to me. My Operation game came rushing to me.
Oh,
like,
Operation.
But that little Operation game, I ended up taking apart and making buzzers out of, so that if my sisters tried to open my door, it would sound an alarm. So I guess I would consider that my favorite.
Okay. You transformed your Operation game to an ADT security system?
Pretty much, yeah. It was, so whenever they went to turn the dial, it would make the connection, and then it would send off the buzzer so that they couldn't get the door fully open. Now, not that I was doing anything wrong on the other side of the door.
That's okay, clear. But okay, even with that being said, I have to do a psychological, analytical type of question. What do you believe you setting up a security system by any means necessary said about your state of being at that age?
We can't make it about my sisters?
No. You created the system.
You know, I really think it was, now that you ask it, I've always had the outside the door and the inside the door kind of personality. Like, when I left my room, I was one person, but when I could be alone by myself, there was always that other me. And then I think it just kept growing. I remember when I ran for political office, people would say, how can you take that? And I'm like, it's not me they're talking about. They're talking about the candidate. Like, I'm like not that I'm bipolar, but that's not me. That's just the me that I have to be in that position. So maybe it was just to make sure that that special me could know if somebody was gonna come in and bust on me.
So I'm not totally clear if it's because I'm a Gemini or because just the life that I've had, but I definitely understand a deep level of compartmentalization of your life. And that's what I call it. I don't call it inside outside. I call it having little silos of yourself that people have. Well, some people have access to and some people don't.
I think it comes in part because I grew up in the Midwest. My mother was the first generation not to grow up on an Amish community. My father, who was my stepfather that raised me, was German Lutheran who grew up in World War II. So we always had this very, you know, stoic kind of image that we had to present. We were always told, you don't talk about that to other people. You don't do that outside this house. You don't tell people our business. You don't have a so we were really schooled on what we should look like when we left the house. And I think we all do that to some degree, but it was very clear to me that who you are isn't as important as who you appear to be in my family's world.
Do you think that that had a significant effect on you in your coming out story?
Oh my God, yes.
How so?
In part, because I had spent so much energy manufacturing the who I should appear to be. Like, I had built the perfect son, the perfect brother, the perfect every image, and I could like put it on like a pair of loafers and be out the door and nobody would notice. And so first, I didn't even know what it was to be gay. I was like, I'm not gay. And people are like, you're looking at boys. I'm like, yeah, I'm not gay. I'm just wishing that I could look like that. That's all. Like, I'm not gay. I'm envious. But so all of those manufactured people that I had placed in the world in other people's lives, I knew that at some point they would figure out that that was the fake one. And then they would want to know what the real one was. And I hadn't spent any time with the real one to know who to produce.
When did and you feel so like the real one showed up?
I'm sorry?
When did you feel like the real one showed up?
I think it's still showing up 30, 40 years later in some ways. I think we continually come out to ourselves and to others, but I think the big coming out, I remember it. Oh my gosh. Do we have to go there?
Oh yeah.
So I had done like most of us do. I packed up and moved really far away from my family, figuring if I screwed up being gay, I was far enough away they couldn't see it. And then I could go back to being straight where they lived. And so I'd been in a relationship and been in all this, and it all just blew up. I mean, we've all had that love of our life that walked out kind of thing. And something said, I'm going to go home and tell my mother what a horrible life I have. But to do that, I would have to tell her also that this horrible life was the result of a man I was sleeping with. And when I told her, she's like, well, I've known for 15 years and I'm still not ready to deal with it. And she got up and left the house. Like, she just left. Sitting there at the kitchen table, having flown 500 miles to have this big moment with her, and she left. She actually left to go eat pie with my sister at the pie place. And I was like, what the am I supposed to be doing here? Like, do I leave before she gets back? Do I stay? About 4 years later, she said, I'm ready to have the conversation. And it was only because my younger sister was getting married and everybody refused to attend the wedding if I wasn't there.
Did you just say everybody refused to go if you weren't there?
Yeah, my four sisters. So what happened was, when I left, I'm like, okay. Well, she said, as she left to go to the pie place, she said, no, I'm not telling anybody, so you can tell your fathers and your sisters in your own way. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write them all a letter, because sitting down to people's table is not working out well. And all of my sisters, I have four sisters, and they all came back with like, yeah, so what? We've known. I'm glad you finally decided to talk about it. I mean, they were really kind of like dull about it. My stepfather wrote back and he said, you know, I grew up in a time and a place that I was taught that being gay was wrong. I mean, again, he grew up in Germany during the occupation of the Nazi army. So he saw gay and lesbians with, you know, the purple triangle. And he said, I grew up in that. I was taught and raised to believe this. I no longer believe this, but I still need to figure it out for myself. Allow me the time, but please be happy kind of letter. And I thought, what a heroic letter for him to admit that he didn't have the tools at hand because nobody had ever discussed it with him, and that I might be the first person, and it happens to be his son, and he was going through it. But he closed with like, I will never judge you based on who you sleep with, but what you do in your life. And so do it well. And I was like, okay, I can live with that mandate. So everybody was like, if we're gonna have this wedding, Eric's gotta come or we're not showing up because we're a family. And it was really to force my mom to finally deal with it.
I really like that. So often we hear stories that do not, like in any way, support the person that is on that journey of coming out. So to actually hear that your family was so in tuned with how you were being treated or possibly going to be treated, that they were willing to boycott a family celebration if you weren't there, because so many times there are so many stories about people saying, if they are coming, I'm not coming, in a way to position that person, you know, further outside of the family circle. So I enjoyed hearing that, and I do understand his letter to you, because I just get that. And I wish so many more people had that language, or even that limited language, that say, I don't understand, I would like to, but I'm not there yet.
Yeah, I still have the letter, I keep it to this day, because I could hear him saying, I know it's wrong. Like, I know intellectually it's wrong. And I know what I was raised in the middle of was wrong and horrific. And I haven't really had to confront that personally in my life since that. And now you've asked me to deal with that, and I need to settle into it. In the meantime, I don't care who you sleep with, because I'm going to judge you faster on the job that you do, the way you, you know, the quality of character of a man you become. And as a son, to hear my dad say, I want to see who you become as a man, not as a gay man, but just that word man standing by itself. I was like, that's what I want to become. I don't want to become a gay man. I want to become a man that happens to have another man beside him.
And I get that. And I so get that. And to go along with what your father said to you about judging you by the quality of life that you live and the things that you do, tell us more about what it is that you do.
Well, it's funny because now when I call my dad and I tell him what I do, he's like, I don't understand it. I'm like, neither do I, but people pay me to help them to tell their story, whether it's in business or in life. And he's like, I don't understand how you make money at that. I'm like, well, Dad, there's some people that haven't figured it out, and they ask me to help them. And then when I help them, their lives turn out better because they're living more into who they are, whether it's as a business or in writing a book. He's like, well, just do a good job. And I'm like, okay, Dad. You know, he's 89 now. That's the extent of it. But it's interesting that I still, at my age and at his age, I still need that sense of like, do a good job. And then he'll ask about the kids and my partner and things like that. And I think as a gay individual and an entrepreneur, it's really, that sense of do a good job, we always question whether we're being judged on the same scale as everybody else. Like, well, you're pretty good at that for a gay person. It's like, well, if I wasn't gay, would it still be a good job? You know, so to have my dad understand what I do when I help people and encourage me, it means a lot.
I appreciate you talking about this gay scale. That is something that almost seems inverted in my experience. It's like, because of the queerness, people expect a higher level of quality. Maybe because we're stereotypically known as being bitchy.
like when I you and we, all of us have had somebody say, do you think this color is better than the other color? And I'm like, why are you asking me? Because you're gay. Like, we're supposed to be overqualified in certain things. But if I told somebody I built a cabin, they're like, but you're gay. Yeah, I built my own house. But you're gay. Like, you can't use tools. Like, how do you build a house? You're gay. If you decorated it, I would understand. But, like, you lifted your own car engine and changed out the transmission, but you're gay. It's so funny that we can't excel in every area equally, that we're like confined to these certain silos of success.
I do get that with today being Veterans Day, and shout out to all my queer veteran siblings out there. With today being Veterans Day, and I made a post, you know, about almost 20 years of military service. And people definitely wonder, like, wait a minute, I thought you just liked guys. I'm like, that has nothing to do with the other. And no, I did not enlist for that reason. Like, I didn't go like, where can I see a lot of young pretty things? Then I enlisted. Like, that was so not a part of my decision-making process. I was literally just trying to pay for school. Like, literally, it wasn't for God and country. It was paper for school. But I do understand totally what you're saying. And I would love to know, how long have you been helping people with your story, with telling their stories?
You know, I have a master's degree in family counseling and social work. So I think part of it really started there, with helping people understand that their story is only part of who they are, because the other part is still undone. And so in social work and family services, it was hearing family stories and then helping them heal their story and then begin to transform their stories as individuals or families. Or I worked with a lot of youth in critical care. And then I began to move into business, and I always wanted to do marketing and branding, but you had to spell words, and people told me I was a horrible speller. And so I always like hedged around it. And in the last five, maybe a little longer, 7 years, I've really started not only in coaching to help people take that skill that I learned back in social work to understand their own story, but then say, you know what, that's such a unique thing. Why aren't you talking more about that? They're like, well, nobody wants to hear it. I'm like, everybody wants to hear it. You just have to figure out how to say it in a way that it's not about you, but it's about the connectivity of all of us, and they will come running. And so working with people, whether it's editing a book or meeting with them and saying, I see your business, but I don't see you. How can we bring that together? So when you go into your office, you're not wearing a mask. You're not hiding who you are in your business with your clients and your customers. And it gives me great joy to know that people are living with purpose and passion because they're living themselves.
Also love that. And with to go into that, do you, and if you do, why do you feel that entrepreneurs, LGBTQ entrepreneurs, have a right or even have the power to tell their stories so that it can show that they are relatable while they are in business?
I'm sorry, I just climbed up on my soapbox here. You have an obligation to not only live your story, but tell your story. And so often what I see entrepreneurs do is they'll look across the fence and they'll say, well, Aisha's got 5,000 followers and he's making this much money. And if I could only copy what he's doing and get 10% of his clients and my business could grow. It's not a zero sum, there's a game. It's not that there's only 100 people spending money. There are more people untouched and untapped than Aisha will ever be able to reach. And if you try and follow him, you'll never become your own self, but you'll also never touch into that untapped group. I'm working with a writer right now, and she has a book about being a miscarriage or having multiple miscarriages. And when we refined her message, she wants to speak directly to women who are in the first 3 weeks following a miscarriage. And everybody would say, oh my gosh, that's such a narrow market. But if you statistically thought how many women have miscarriages, first, that's a huge market. But second, how many of them are desperate for a voice that's speaking directly to that moment when they're still trying to figure out their pain, their loss, and the next step forward? Only because she's been there, only because she stands in that moment so clearly in her book, can she reach into other people's life from that moment. And so I say, entrepreneurs, if you want to reach into other people's life, really reach into their life, you have to reach into yours. Stand in that moment so solid, so clear, so defined, that people will be like, that's my man. He knows exactly what I lived, and I need him. And then you don't have to spend all your energy chasing down leads and clients and building these funnels, because they will come to you like a lighthouse. They'll be like, man, your message brought goosebumps to me. I need you. Wouldn't it be neat to be an entrepreneur that woke up and had like 10 calls saying, I need you, when are you available? Versus you going the other direction saying, I really would like you to maybe consider being my client. So yes, oh my God, yes. You have to. Huh?
I said, oh my God, yes.
and it's so funny, because as gay and lesbian individuals, we live in such insecurity that we have significance first just because of our gender identity, but then our stories have value. And so we begin to manufacture all of these crazy stories. And I told you, I lived them, and I got burned out, and I got beat up, and I got wasted living them. And it's like, you know what? I don't need the whole world to love me. I need just a really like 0.0001% of the world to get my message. And I'll have made an amazing impact. And so the clearer you are on who you are and what your message is, the quicker you'll get to that 0.0001%.
As you're talking, I'm definitely being in the moment as you're saying what you're saying. And one thing that just came to my mind is, maybe, is, would you agree or would you not agree that one possibility of why our queer siblings who are entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs, the reason why they don't tell their story is they don't believe their story is worth telling because they're worthy themselves?
Oh, I tell, yes. Oh, please. I remind everybody, anytime I do a podcast, anytime I do anything on my show, you are worthy. You are abundantly and completely worthy of whatever your dreams are. Whatever joy you seek, you are abundantly, divinely worthy of it. You would not be alive in this moment if you weren't worthy of what comes in the next moment. Now, I can say it, but you have to internalize it. And it's in the internalizing that it becomes really challenging. And I get that, because I lived feeling like I was just, you know, gum on the bottom of somebody's shoe. But in my heart, like in my real, like in that locked behind my bedroom door heart, I knew that there was something about me that was worth being alive that day. And now as an adult, I get to express it freely and openly, because it's like, you don't pay my mortgage, so you can't tell me what to live and think. So yeah, everybody's story is worthy or they wouldn't be here. Even the one that people toss away, I can guarantee you, give me 30 minutes and I'll tell you what makes your story unique.
I like that challenge. I really do. And if you're listening, I dare you to take him up on that challenge. I double dog dare you. And one thing,
honestly, you sit and you tell me your story with truth, I'll find it. And you'll be like, oh yeah. Because so often we live the story and we don't see the significance of it because we're in the moment of living it. But for me, the outsider, I'm like, I can't imagine what that moment was like. Teach me. Like, oh my God, like how? So yeah, you have a story.
I get that. For the benefit of myself and for the benefit of the third person in this session right now, as far as your story, there's one part of your story that I get a kick out of, and that's the story of I believe it was the first Pride in Atlanta.
I'm not sure we're gonna call it that first pride. We're just calling it.
Okay. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, I want to know about that story.
You know, it was because, again, for many of the, the children's, when they come to Atlanta, there's a couple hundred thousand people. It's a 3-day event. There's floats. There's cars. There's all kinds. Back in the old days, when Pride first kicked off, we were watching it around the country thinking we should do something like that. And by we, a couple of us sitting at the end of a bar. And so we agreed to gather at the Capitol building. And if there was 100 people, it was because somebody brought a friend that we weren't expecting. And we quickly marched around the Capitol. We had our shirts and our flags. And we were like, yeah, we're queer. We're here. We're gay. Okay. Just after we did one loop around the Capitol, which is about 2 blocks, we headed back to the bar and said, we did it. Whew. Okay. We had our pride. Now you come to Atlanta and it's like, straight families from Alabama come to be a part of it. Everybody shows up. And a couple of the old ones that were there, they're still around, and we think back and we're looking like, you remember that night? You remember that fear? But we had to make a stand at least once and see what happened.
So what year was that?
Well, now you're going to date me. What would it have been? It had to be I'd have to look at, but I think it was 84, 86, something like that. Maybe a little later, but it wasn't much beyond that. Atlanta and Pride and gay. What's interesting is Atlanta has always been this gay mecca for everybody in the South. Like, any little queer boy from Alabama headed to Atlanta because they didn't have enough money to get to New York or San Francisco. And so there was always this like people coming in, but when they came in, they got like pushed below ground somehow. And now when they come in, they just explode all over the surface. But back in the old days, back in Atlanta, when the bars were dark and they were kind of like, I mean, there's one in I remember North Carolina, it was called CC's. It's Capitol Corral if you're from North Carolina. But they didn't even put the name on the door. And you only knew it was there because somebody told you what door to go in. If you went in the wrong one, I think you went to like some beauty salon. That's the way Atlanta was back in the day. I mean, they were queers, but you had to find them.
So I appreciate that story. Being an 80s baby circa 1983, I appreciate that story and every story like it. One reason why I do is because I am infatuated and in awe of every single solitary queer identified individual in that realm of time that allowed there to be a cultural shift from being underground in the corner in the darkness to coming out into the light, regardless of what that meant after they did the act. So if that meant getting fired for their jobs, being disowned by family members, by congregations of houses of worship, being disowned, like all of it, I am truly in awe, and not just in awe from a voyeuristic point of view, but also very grateful, because the reason why a little black queer boy from Oklahoma City can have an entire brand around helping LGBTQ plus entrepreneurs, from a podcast to a masterclass to a coming show to a book to everything. The reason why I can do what I do is because of you and people like you. So if you never get a thank you, if you never get a rose, if you never get an applause, I am telling you right now, on behalf of all of us, thank you.
Well, I'll receive it. But I also want to say it wasn't... So as my son told me the other day during his homeschool exercise, that I'm older than Walmart and the iPad. Of course, he flunked that last night. No, he was right. back in the day, we didn't have the cell phone, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have all of this communication that we could safely sit in a place and connect to our community until we were ready to go to the next level. And so it was more often out of just a sense of desperation and isolation that you would, you know, like try and create a community and try and identify with the community and just survive in this bubble. Because as you said, so many people, when they came out alone. Their families left them, their churches left them, their jobs left them. And they were like, I just need somebody, like some human being. And so the bar scene wasn't necessarily about getting drunk and cruising and all that, though that did happen. Other people did that. It was really about just having a safe place to sit and say, do you know what I'm saying? And somebody go, I gotcha. I gotcha. I hear you. And so the bar scene and all of those things that happened pre 19 whatever, or 1990, 2000 even, were simply out of survival. They weren't meant to create a movement per se. It was just to get through a day.
Well, movement, no movement, just to get the drink and be okay, regardless of whatever it came. I'm just appreciated that it happened.
I said, it makes life so much easier.
Yeah, because I'm like totally infatuated with that era in regards to film, documentary. So like, of course, I cannot tell you, because I don't know the many times I watched Paris is Burning, even though that was in New York, not in Atlanta, but still, it was that era. So I have no idea how many times I watched Paris is Burning. I have no idea how many times I have ran through all the episodes of the two seasons that have been shown of Pose so far, and I'm excited for the third season. I'm just infatuated with that idea because I know that it's like on the cusp. It's like they didn't know, you all didn't know that you were on the cusp of something wonderful for the rest of us. Like, you just didn't know.
But I want to caution you that the good old days are still, like, I wrote a screenplay regarding our kids because we adopted our children in one of the most Republican counties in the South possible. And we stood in a court of law and had somebody tell the judge that if he awarded custody of the children to us, it would be an abomination to God and that God would strike the judge down, and nobody objected. So that moment has not, I mean, we were the first couple to be awarded a birth certificate with same-sex parents on it. Like literally the certificate had to be ordered special and they had to go through all this mechanics because they wanted one of us to decide who would be listed as mother and who would be listed as father. And I was like, I'm not being the mother. I'm like, if you change it to top and bottom, we might be able to come up with a solution. They had to order less than 10 years ago. So we're not done. By no means are we done.
And no, and I would not even fix my mouth, as my mother would say, to even consider that we were done, because I believe that when we are done, coming out won't be a thing. It'll just be. So
yeah,
like gender fluidness, like all that can just be a thing.
Yeah, we have safe harbors to rest and recover, like the big cities, or even now with the internet and social groups and what you do, Aisha. There are harbors for us to gain our strengths, but they're like, you know, as a coach, ships aren't meant to live in the harbor. No. We as entrepreneurs, gay and lesbian entrepreneurs, by being successful, by really making territory in our individual industries, not because we're gay, but because we're entrepreneurs who build successful businesses, then they can't be like, well, he was good for a gay. No, they're going to be like, you know, he's damn good at what he does. Mm-hmm. That's where begin to push the next boundary where people can't deny us our success or can't credit it to, well, you know, he's got the gay gene, so of course he knew how to decorate your house. Mm-hmm. Like, no. Stop giving me, you know. So yeah, gay entrepreneurs, you have got to take the ground because we can do more with money than we can with voice. And as you're a successful entrepreneur and you create wealth in your life, then you get to decide where that wealth goes, into what organizations, into what fellow businesses. And that's where the next movement really begins.
And that's a great entry segue into my last question. Like, that's the perfect segue. So if you can please consider and put your third eye on a queer little human in middle America that lives in a place where there are no gay bars, no gay organizations, no gay associations, there's no WeHo, there's no Midtown in Atlanta, nothing like that exists where they are. And they just need to know that they can make it another day. What would you have to say to this human?
I guess what I would tell is that you're in the moment that you're in for a purpose. Now, you may not see it, you may not understand it, it may seem really hard and dark, but take it all in. Like, be a part of it as fully as you can, because there's going to be a day when you can reflect back on that and it will give you strength and it will give you courage and it will give you wisdom, but more importantly, it might give you compassion for the person that you're supposed to step into their life and help. Yeah, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to change overnight. It's not going to be magical. But if you own where you're at while you're there, you'll gain so much more than trying to fight with it. Yeah, you're worthy. You're worthy of what you dream. But finish what you're doing now before you move to the next thing.
And with that, I say thank you, thank you, thank you. Please, everyone, know that Eric G. Reed will be there for you at the Proud and Paid Masterclass happening November 20th and 21st. His contact information will be in the show notes. As always, I am Ace Laveau. Dreams and blessings.